This is Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Rank and File Radio is a weekly program covering labor issues from national and international perspectives. We are your hosts, Doug Nesbitt
and Andrew Stevens. On this week's show, Doug and I talk about the growing robocall scandal, the Quebec student strike, and other issues affecting workers in our Labor Talk segment.
But first, here's this week's labor news update.
After months of work to rule actions in an effort to secure a new collective agreement, 41,000 BC teachers went on strike for 3 days, beginning Monday, March 5th. The Friday before, an estimated 10,000 students walked out of BC schools in solidarity with the teachers. Here's a voice from a Vancouver student walkout.
Class sizes, special needs funding, and specialized learning, which is needed for our generation, has not been adequate. You cannot expect every student in BC to learn algebra in a class of 35. We are one teacher. And those students who need more time to do their work should not be degraded into lower levels of learning.
On Tuesday, March 6, an estimated 5,000 teachers rallied in Victoria in front of the BC legislature. Pickets have also been set up at government buildings staffed by members of the BC Government and Service Employees Union, resulting in a shutdown of many government workplaces. The BCGEU is one of the few unions with a contract that gives them the right not to cross the picket lines of other unions. However, the Liberal government is claiming this to be illegal and has taken the complaint to the province's Labor Relations Board.
With the strike entering its third and final legal day, the BC Liberals are planning to introduce Bill 22, which would impose a contract upon the teachers in an effort to achieve their stated goal of a net zero contract. This means the net costs of wages and benefits in the new contract would not increase at all. The bill would implement a wage freeze and erode working conditions for teachers and learning conditions for students, such as increasing class sizes. This is one reason why thousands of BC students have engaged in walkouts over the past week in solidarity with teachers. The government is presenting Bill 22 as a form of mediation. However, the BC Federation of Labor counters that there are existing mechanisms for mediation, mechanisms that the government has flatly refused to pursue. The government has also refused arbitration while presenting a series of concessionary demands on the union. While using the familiar rhetoric of balancing the provincial budget, an Ipsos poll shows that while 6 out of 10 residents oppose the strike action, a plurality of residents support the teachers over the government. The widest margin is amongst those aged 18 to 34, with 45% supporting the teachers and only 24% supporting the government.
With the contracts of Ontario's teachers expiring in August, Ontario Premier Dalton McGuinty made a public plea over YouTube for teachers to accept a 2-year wage freeze and an end to their current sick leave plan.
Here in Ontario, the people who work in our schools are second to none. You help us deliver a world-class, publicly funded education to our students. And I want to thank you for all that you've achieved, together with students and parents, these past 8 years. Class sizes are down, test scores are up, and more of our young people are graduating than ever before. Did you know, Ontario schools have been independently ranked the best in the English-speaking world as we overcome the challenges of a tough global economy together? We're not going to give up the gains in education that we achieved together. But our reality is this. While education funding will still grow, we're going to have to focus on things that allow our children to achieve the best possible results. And because salaries account for most of that education funding, we're going to be asking all those working in education to do their part to help us slow down spending.
McGuinty's appeal comes on the heels of the Drummond Commission report published last month. The report calls for extensive austerity measures across all provincially delivered public services. The report included plans to lay off several thousand non-union teaching assistants in public schools, but avoided language directly addressing the collective agreements of public sector workers such as the teachers. After the video was posted online, the leaders of Ontario's 5 teachers' unions requested an emergency meeting with the Premier.
Despite $4 billion in cash holdings, American Airlines declared bankruptcy in November 2011. The long-term consequences for the tens of thousands of workers employed by American will be nothing less than catastrophic. As one article in the U.S.-based Labor Notes reads, bankruptcy is being used as a means to break unions and increase company profits. What makes American's decision so painful for its employees is that unions representing workers at the airline have made billions of dollars worth of concessions since 2003. The airline industry was still reeling from the effects following 9/11, but despite the highly competitive business environment, the major carriers are still reaping billions in profits. Boeing told Reuters that in the long term, the bankruptcy of American is a very good thing. By dumping workers' pensions and wages, the company will be able to increase its fleet by purchasing new aircraft and grow its share prices. Boeing will be the largest beneficiary after the restructuring. American aims to lay off over 13,000 workers, or 16% of the workforce. $9 billion of unfunded pension obligations will be unloaded to a federal insurance agency. In the process of declaring bankruptcy, the company also seeks to end retiree health care for 130,000 current and former workers.
On Saturday, March 3rd, members of Parliament, union leaders, and citizens demonstrated in Vancouver to protest against the federal Conservative government over the so-called robocalls scandal. Hundreds of people took part in the action. The march began at the Vancouver Art Gallery. Protesters and politicians from across the country have called for an inquiry into the matter. Here is Sarah Bueller, co-organizer of the Vancouver rally, speaking to demonstrators.
We're going to take the streets, and we're going to show that the real power in Canada belongs to the people. Yeah. For every person who is on this march today, right, there are thousands of Canadians who wish they could be here. We represent people from every province and every territory who are appalled that the bedrock of Canadian democracy is being attacked by this Harper government.
The scandal began after it was revealed that Elections Canada was investigating an incident in Guelph, Ontario, of voters being called on the phone and told to go to polls that didn't exist during the May federal election. Elections Canada is now reviewing more than 31,000 reports of robocalls in dozens of ridings. Columnists writing for the National Post, Calgary Herald, the Vancouver Sun, and the Ottawa Citizen have been critical of the government, despite being traditional Conservative supporters. A second rally is said to be planned for March 11th in Ottawa.
On March 3rd, the anonymous group, McGill Leaks, published confidential documents it acquired from McGill University's Development and Alumni Relations. The documents relate to the university's fundraising initiatives and reveal strategy briefs, lists of individual and corporate targets, donor profiles, travel information, memoranda, and more. McGill Leaks plans on making public hundreds more documents in the next few weeks for the purpose of, quote, critical analysis and initiative. The first release focuses on pharmaceutical, biotechnology, and defense industries. Corporate and individual profiles are included in the documents. University advancement, alumni, and research offices have a long-standing relationship with wealthy benefactors and corporations. This is nothing new. However, there are implications for staff, students, and faculty when confidential information is released to the public and whether or not these employees will be protected by safe disclosure and whistleblower policies that exist at universities and other public institutions. The documents can be found online at mcgillleaks.wordpress.com.
The Quebec student strike, which began in a handful of universities and SAGEPs in February, has grown to over 125,000 students. Students are facing an unprecedented increase in tuition fees, $1,625 over 5 years, or $325 a year. Several mass demonstrations have been organized in recent weeks, including a demonstration in the tens of thousands in Montreal, in which students who blockaded the Jacques Cartier Bridge were tear-gassed. A demonstration of 10,000 at the National Assembly in Quebec City was also tear-gassed by riot police. This is the second mass student strike against the Charest government in less than a decade. In early 2005, a student general strike succeeded in repealing the so-called education reforms implemented by Charest. These involved the replacement of $103 million in student grants with $103 million in loans. The 2005 strike took weeks to grow to over 200,000 students. The current strike, while still growing, is notable for the participation of Anglophone students at traditionally more conservative universities such as McGill. The lengthy McGill support staff strike last fall galvanized students, especially in the wake of several incidents in which police indiscriminately attacked pickets and supporting students. The strike has been mobilized at the departmental and faculty level, with general assemblies of students voting on a number of strike options, such as a one-day strike, three-day strike, or unlimited strike. Once the short-term strike mandates expire, general assemblies reconvene to vote on extending the strike. The strike has been publicly supported by the left-wing MNA, Quebec Solidaire's Amir Kadir. A mass demonstration in Montreal is being organized for March 22nd.
Stay tuned after these messages for our Labour Talk segment on Rank and File Radio.
There will be no more policing of what feminism is, who is a feminist, and who gets to decide.
Women have the right to be safe and secure in their own bodies.
How can Canada say that we have equality when those women can't shelter themselves from violence and don't have decent housing and food to eat? That's not equality!
There are all these different oppressions that intersect, and then you can see violence as one of the glues that hold together all these oppressions.
And we will always be reclaiming and redefining so long as our mouths are going to stay open and are going to stay loud, because we ain't going to be shut up.
International Women's Day has been observed since the early 1900s. Every year, thousands of events are held throughout the world to inspire women and celebrate achievements. This year, on March 8th, CFRC presents International Women's Day Focus Programming. We will feature interviews with feminist organizations, musicians, and activists talking about local, national, and international experiences of women. So on March 8th, set your dial to CFRC 101.9 FM or listen online at cfrc.ca from 1 till 8 p.m. to celebrate International Women's Day.
Oprah Kingston presents Push It Hip Hop Festival from March 3rd to March 9th. On March 9th, check out Humble the Poet,
Flood the City Like the Levees Broke, Spoke Heavy, Tell My Tongues Are Sweaty, Soak We Ready, Folks, You Ready Know,
Lol, and High Fidelic.
And the smoke in my lungs, the lonely one with a broken tongue, glow like the sun, illuminate children of God. We come from the slums, there's drugs and guns, death squads burn.
At the Renaissance for an all-ages show. Tickets are $10, available at the door or in advance at the Grey House. Check out hiphop.oprahkingston.org for more details and a full listing of concerts and workshops.
Welcome back. You're listening to Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9. This is a segment we want to call Labor Talk. This week, Doug and I are going to address two issues. First, the growing robocall scandal, and second, the Halifax transit strike. As we highlighted in the news segment, the robocall scandal began after it was revealed that Elections Canada was investigating an incident at Guelph, Ontario, of voters being called on the phone and told to go to the polls that didn't exist during the May federal election. An election, we should add, that resulted in a Conservative majority government. Elections Canada is now reviewing more than 31,000 reports of robocalls in dozens of ridings, and the scandal has erupted to such an extent that even the Conservative base in the media is starting to call for a public inquiry. We want to start with a clip here by John Ibbotson, Canadian writer and journalist who is currently the Globe and Mail's Ottawa Bureau Chief. Here's Ibbotson's, here's what Ibbotson had to say about the scandal on the Globe's website.
The robocall affair is the biggest bit of bad news to land on the Harper government's plate since the last election. It refers to allegations that Conservative staffers during that election might have placed automated calls to try to mislead voters in certain key ridings. Well, how big a deal is this? It depends on two things. One is the leaky faucet factor. If we get new allegations, new evidence, new complaints day after day after day, well, that will keep the story alive and it will make the story grow bigger and bigger. But if that faucet gets cut off and we don't get new allegations or new evidence, human nature is that you move on to other things. And months from now, if charges do get laid or a report does come out, well, it'll be yesterday's news. The other factor is the euchre factor. Is something going to come along to trump this story? Jim Flaherty's budget, the NDP leadership campaign. They will take turn attention away, for sure, for a while. But will attention turn back? Ultimately, it depends on the story itself. Was this an isolated incident, a few staffers and a few writings who got carried away, or something bigger going on? That's what the leaky faucet factor and the euchre factor ultimately will determine.
Again, that was John Ibbotson, Globe and Mail's Ottawa bureau chief, notable writer and journalist, talking about the robocall scandal. He mentioned two things here, the leaky faucet and the euchre factor. Doug, what do you think about these?
Well, as you know, I was pretty angry about when I first heard this. The way he explains it is that the story, he's essentially absolving the mainstream media from any sort of responsibility to pursue the story. The story, he's treating it as if it's independent of what journalists do. So the leaky faucet factor seems to be whether or not new revelations emerge. There's no consideration on whether journalists have any responsibility to pursue new allegations, to put together the pieces of the puzzle about what's gone on here and start investigating past Conservative Party practices that are actually in many ways similar to this. And also the euchre factor, whether another story trumps this, is again, that's something that is up to the editors of the mainstream newspapers, such as the Globe and Mail. So in the end, Ibbotson is saying that journalists, not the mainstream media, not journalists, have no actual influence on where this story goes. They're totally independent factors. And maybe I'm pushing the argument a little bit, but the notion that the mainstream media doesn't have a role in how this is covered is frankly totally absurd and absolving themselves of the responsibility to inform the public and hold power to account. I just think this is pretty reflective of how the mainstream media is covering the issues that we try to cover on this show, which is labor-related issues.
Yeah, we've talked about this before. One of the things that we always come back to is how this might actually tie into a few ideas that we've discussed, like neoliberalism or the growing corporatization of politics, of public institutions, and so on. And ultimately, what does this mean or has this meant since the Conservatives took power in 2006 and then accelerated with a majority government? Do you think there's some... Does this tie into a broader trend of cynicism or problems in the democratic or political fabric of the country?
Well, there's a certain, probably the most important element missing from Ibbotson's commentary, and I have talked to some people about this commentary, and they say, oh, he's just making observations about the story itself. But Ibbotson doesn't actually mention what is at stake here, that we have a profound violation of a very simple principle, which is free and fair elections. It doesn't matter whether or not the robocalls change the outcome of a particular election in a riding or whether those ridings were Tory safe seats or not. It's really the principle that was violated. And I suppose when it relates to questions of neoliberalism and labor policy, you have the same unwillingness of the press to begin tying together a series of seemingly disconnected or disparate events. And I think that with some of these strikes that are going on right now, you're starting to see the gaps in the mainstream media and able to use the evidence of what's going on, say, with the BC teacher strike or the Quebec student strike or the transit strike in Halifax or what happened with the electromotive diesel factory in London, and inability to tie these things together in an effort, perhaps futile because there are no connections between them, but a failure simply to investigate whether or not this is part of some sort of systemic problem. And there's a great article in the Globe and Mail recently called Halifax Labor Woes, A Symbol for the Nation, in which Jim Stanford, the auto workers union economist, actually does make this connection. Not the journalists, I should add, but Jim Stanford cited in it does make the connection, explaining that what happened in Caterpillar in London has given public sector employers, i.e. governments, the kind of willingness to take on unions. The unions right now are not fighting for brand new demands. They're actually trying to defend what they have, on top of already giving in a number of concessions during the height of the crisis a few years ago.
I suppose for the benefit of our audiences, we should probably define some of the ideas that we've talked about. One is neoliberalism, which I think is one of the most widely used and perhaps least and most poorly defined concepts. And I think as we've talked about before, we're using it to define really a process, economic and social, where business interests saturate people's lives. It dominates political discussion. It involves how policies are made in the business world, but also how they're made in the halls of government, in public institutions like universities, dominated by interests that aren't necessarily premised on quality public services and discussion, but instead how it benefits companies, stock prices, and how we can all benefit ostensibly, as the argument goes, from a reform of politics in such a way as we're seeing in, I think, in the cynicism of Ibbotson's comments, where we're thinking in very narrow ways about what today's issues are. And so I think a bigger issue at play here is how we're losing sight of the big picture, the role of institutions like media and really journalists themselves in keeping governments and institutions, other institutions in account. I'm thinking of a book here I recently read by Stephen McBride and Heather Whiteside called Private Affluence and Public Austerity, which is published by Friendwood Press. And they make an interesting argument in that they talk about a democratic malaise that is tied in part to the conservative government. And I think that's important to consider, that there has perhaps been, I mean, this is a bigger sociological and political argument about what's changed since 2006, perhaps earlier. But I mean, there's both cynicism and some silver linings on what's going on with this scandal. People seem to be caring. I think the question now is on whether or not that interest is going to be sustained, if it's the NDP leadership rates or if it's the economy, if it's a budget, and so on. That said, I think most importantly for the show, and for us, it's been the concern for labor and unions. Really, what is this scandal going to mean for working people and for their organizations? We've seen, as the news segment highlighted, the protest that took place over the weekend in Vancouver that involved politicians, sitting members of parliament, unions, and average citizens. So I want to change gears here, if you will, and focus on what these arguments mean in Halifax and the Halifax transit strike. And again, I want to start by playing a clip by riders of the transit system that they made about the strike and about the union and about the workers. And this clip first appeared on the Halifax Co-op, News Co-op website. So here's the clip.
I've never been involved in a strike before. This is the first time. I have been involved with another union, the inside workers with the city, for 10 years before I came over here. And there was negotiations, which means this is what we want to do. And the negotiating team from the other side goes back, well, we can't accept that, but let's work on this.
There is no negotiations here. They gave us a couple of packages, said take this or you should take this one. You know, and that's not to negotiate. That's there's an ultimatum. That take package A, take package B, or get nothing.
And this is not what I expected from a strike whatsoever. I would expect that negotiation means exactly what that is. But this all or nothing attitude, I feel like I'm being railroaded to accept something that is not fair for me or the people coming up behind me.
The buses still could have been on the road if they had actually sit in the same room and talk about it. And, you know, even if it's a little bit every single day, even if it's one sentence they fixed every day, these buses still could have been out on the road and people could be going to where they need to be and people still have their jobs and nobody would be worrying about where the next meal is coming from.
In the last 4 weeks, while the strike is happening, you would expect there to be more face-to-face conversations. about how we're going to resolve this. But there haven't been those face-to-face conversations, or at least, I feel, not enough of them.
They should have come to us 3-6 months in advance, sit down with us, explained it to us, and so we can make our minds up. They just threw a piece of paper at us 15 minutes before I went to work, and we're out. I said to the manager that day, I said, why are you doing this now? This should have been done 3 months ago. He even actually agreed with me, and I said, we're going to be out in strike tonight. This is absolutely insane. It's just irresponsible.
All right, those were some of the voices from a clip that can be found on the Halifax Media Co-op website. Interestingly, Doug, the co-op recently published your article on the 2008-2009 Ottawa transit strike. What kind of parallels do you see happening in Ottawa 3-4 years ago and those happening in Halifax today?
Well, from my understanding, Halifax, like Ottawa, has an important public transit system, but is generally underfunded and inadequate when it comes to meeting the needs of its ridership, which are essentially the poor, the students, and workers in general. These are the people who rely on it. So you would think that there would be a natural affinity between the union and the ridership, but this is not the case. Like Halifax is in Ottawa, there is a generally underdeveloped and almost non-existent strategy of outreach to the public from the union to its ridership and the wider public. And this gives, at the outset of the labor dispute, a real advantage to the employer, City Hall, and which are also reinforced by generally hostile coverage from the right-of-center dailies like the Chronicle Herald in Halifax or the Citizen in Ottawa. So, as this is playing out in Halifax, we're seeing some of the similar patterns that played out in the Ottawa transit strike. You have a public that is against the union and maybe also angry at City Hall, but this doesn't really help resolve the situation. And you're also seeing an employer who's essentially unwilling to negotiate while also demanding significant concessions from the unions. When it comes to the bigger picture, these two transit strikes, and I think definitely in the case of other public sector strikes that have happened recently, is that organized labor is operating under the assumption that the post-war compromise, the model of labor management relations to sort out these sort of disputes is still in operation, and that the public in general grasps this sort of compromise and how it's supposed to operate. I don't think that's really the case anymore. Under the current phase of neoliberalism, we're not seeing a period of a long boom like after the war. We're seeing a period of austerity, and the unions, I believe, have to adapt to this and start seeing outreach to the wider working class and the community in general as a necessary ongoing project. So when these inevitable disputes erupt, there is already a constituency, an alliance set up between the public and the unions at the outset of these disputes.
All right, thanks a lot, Doug, for the analysis. I think what we're seeing developing over time and what we're going to see in the future really is some pivotal moments that could lead to a transition in Canadian industrial relations and labor relations generally that could be defined really by cutbacks in austerity rather than prospects of growth. As a way of conclusion, again, I want to really provide a plug for the book Private Affluence, Public Austerity, Economic Crisis and Democratic Malaise in Canada by Stephen McBride and Heather Whiteside. McBride is a professor in the Department of Political Science and Canada Research Chair in Public Policy and Globalization at McMaster University. And Heather Whiteside is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Political Science at Simon Fraser University. And I think it touches upon a lot of the key issues that we've addressed during the show, and I think will be really important at examining policymaking and labor relations in Canada. That's all the time we have this week. Join Rank and File Radio next Wednesday, 5:30 to 6 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Stay tuned.
When I was a little bitty baby, my mama would rock me in the cradle in them old cotton field back home. Was down in Louisiana, just about a mile from Texarkana, in them old cotton fields back home. the bottom